After the code was created on the PDP-1, it was transferred on paper tape to the Honeywell computer, where it was converted into Honeywell's machine language, a chore handled by a program known as an assembler, which converted the code into the ones and zeros the 516 could understand. The assembled code was then punched onto paper tape. For a while, the programmers tried using the assembler that came with the Honeywell 516, but it was so inefficient they soon abandoned it. Walden and Cosell spent 14 hours one weekend on an assembly of the IMP system code, using almost an entire box, nearly half a mile of tape. Not long after that, Cosell wrote some code to modify the much better assembler on the BBN's time-shared PDP-1 computer down the hall. This made it possible for the PDP-1 to produce machine language tapes for the Honeywell 516. From then on, the team wrote pieces of IMP code, edited them, and assembled them under the PDP-1 time-sharing system. Once he was satisfied with an assembly process, the programmer would instruct the PDP-1 to punch out the assembled code on a paper tape, then carry the tape back to the lab where the 516 sat. He would load the tape into the 516, run it, and wait to see what happened. Usually there would be some bugs, and so the process would be repeated. Naturally, when one of the programmers saw something interesting or quirky happening as a new piece of code ran on the 516, the team members would gravitate to the event and stand around the Honeywell talking it over. Most of the IMP guys lived close to Cambridge, and it was easy for them to check in and out of the lab at any hour. Chef Choice Chen's original Chinese restaurant was next door to BBN, and that helped when they worked late, as they often did. Cosell and Walden drank a lot of Coke to keep themselves going. Crowther never touched the stuff. He was a notoriously finicky eater. Anything beyond the culinary level of a plain bologna sandwich was a risk, making him an impossible dinner guest or dining companion. Early in the project, BBN was asked to brief a group of high-level ARPA and military personnel at the Pentagon. Crowther was among those planning to make the trip on behalf of the IMP guys. Hart grew nervous just thinking about what Crowther might wear to the briefing. People were sure to notice his feet, thought Hart. The only time that anyone could remember Crowther wearing shoes you could shine was the day he got married. Hart went to Ornstein and asked him to tell Crowther not to wear sneakers to the Pentagon. Ornstein did.
"Willie, Frank says you shouldn't wear your sneakers to this meeting."
There was a long silence at the other end of the line, and then Crowther's calm voice.
"Tell Frank they've seen my sneakers in JSAC, Joint Services Advisory Committee, meetings before, and it'll be okay."
It was. Crowther and Ornstein were among Hart's most devoted staffers, but they loved to kid the boss when the chance arose. "Frank took things very, very seriously," Ornstein observed. Ornstein was an outspoken opponent of the Vietnam War. By 1969, a lot of people who had never questioned their own involvement in Pentagon-sponsored research projects began having second thoughts. Ornstein had taken to wearing a lapel pin that said "Resist." The pin also bore the Omega sign for electrical resistance, a popular anti-war symbol for electrical engineers. One day, before a Pentagon briefing, Ornstein conceived a new use for his pin. In meetings at the Pentagon, it wasn't unusual for the men around the table to remove their jackets and roll up their shirt sleeves. Ornstein told Hart that he was going to pin his resist button onto a general's jacket when no one was looking.
"I think Frank actually worried that I would," said Ornstein.
Ornstein didn't, but he did wear his pin to the meeting. As the IMP guys laid out their plans in Washington, it became apparent that the ARPA network would be a hybrid of the original ideas of Barron and Davies. The ARPA network would use an adaptive routing scheme that the IMP guys had developed on their own, but which was similar to the basic idea that Barron had sketched. However, unlike Barron's theoretical network, the ARPA network would not have nearly the same redundancy level or number of links to each node.
Nodes in the BBN scheme were normally linked to two neighboring nodes, occasionally to one or three. As it was now conceived, just two failed links could divide or partition the network into isolated segments. Paul Barron had said that a network with a multitude of redundant links could be built of inexpensive parts. If a part malfunctioned, there would be others to back it up. The low level of redundancy in the ARPA network was closer to Davy's plan. Hart's approach was to make every part of the network as robust and reliable as possible. During the proposal period, Crowther and Walden had already done some very crucial work, with amazing results. First, they had found a way to make adaptive routing work efficiently. They had also discovered that they could make the system run much faster than anyone imagined. Observers said their code wouldn't work. Crowther and Walden knew it would. In writing the kernel of their program, the very small part that is the only thing that matters, as Crowther put it, they had discovered how few commands would actually be needed in a software program to pull the packets into the IMP, figure out where to send them, and push them out on the next line. Crowther and Walden quickly worked out the critical algorithms, the basic rules for solving the packet processing and routing problems. That had led them to the determination that it would take only 150 lines of code to process a packet through one of the IMPs. But without a real machine to test it on, running the code would have to wait. Nonetheless, they had a good feeling the IMP would work. A key task that Hart worried about, but didn't have to handle, was the subcontract with AT&T. It was Larry Roberts's responsibility to arrange for the 50-kilobit lines, able to transmit about 2 pages of text per second, into each host site by the date the IMPs were ready. Roberts turned the job over to another Pentagon agency, now working with AT&T on the terms for the installation and leasing of the proper lines, modems, and other communications gear necessary to form links in the network. The physical connection from the IMPs to the local telephone office was to be made by normal telephone wire, two twisted pairs of copper wires wrapped in a cable containing about 1,000 other twisted pairs, with special terminating equipment at each end to support the high data rates. The dedicated lines and other equipment were to be in place at the California sites by the time the first IMPs arrived in the fall. Hart knew the telephone company was going to have to scramble to meet its obligations, and he was glad that securing AT&T's cooperation wasn't his problem. Roberts was a distant but persistent force, vital to the project. His style was to stay out of the way of principal investigators most of the time. Whenever he did inject himself into a project, he never wasted anyone's time. He always made his point and moved on. People in the growing computer community came to regard Roberts highly. These were great days to be running the Information Processing Techniques Office at ARPA. With Taylor and Roberts there, the budget for computing research kept growing, even as the rest of ARPA's funds were being slashed because of the escalating cost of the Vietnam War. IPTO's managers could spend money on priorities of their own choosing, and they could just as easily rescind funding if they didn't receive the kind of cooperation they wanted from contractors. Giving ample authority to people like Roberts was typical of ARPA's management style, which stretched back to its earliest days. It was rooted in a deep trust of frontline scientists and engineers. On his deathbed in 1969, Dwight Eisenhower asked a friend about my scientists and said they were one of the few groups that I encountered in Washington who seemed to be there to help the country and not help themselves. Indeed, many of the best scientists in the country, Roberts among them, came to view working for the agency as an important responsibility, a way of serving. But ARPA administrators were not well paid. Ornstein once met up with Roberts at an out-of-town meeting and saw Roberts driving a banged-up little rental car. Ornstein asked him why on earth he would rent such a heap. Roberts muttered something about how Ornstein didn't understand government rules and expenses. "I always thought of him as passing out these millions of dollars," said Ornstein. it hadn't occurred to me that he was in fact living, personally, on quite a limited budget. People like Larry sacrificed themselves for a while in order to get their hands on a big throttle. Roberts was treated in most respects as if he were a member of the BBN team, even though he was in Washington. He didn't travel to Cambridge often, yet his presence was constantly felt. Since only a few people were working on the project at BBN, Roberts sat down with everyone together when he visited. These were informal talks about their progress, lengthy, high-level rump sessions. As principal investigator and group manager, Frank Hart was Roberts's main point of contact at BBN, but Roberts also stayed in close touch with Kahn. Each site was responsible for building a custom interface between host and IMP. Since computers of various makes were involved, no single interface would do for all the sites. This entailed a separate hardware and software development project at each site, and was not something the host teams could throw together overnight. The IMP guys had to write the host-to-IMP specification before the hosts could start building anything. Hart's most urgent order of business was to complete BBN's design of the host-to-IMP specification, so people at UCLA could begin working in time to meet Roberts' schedule. Hart was already predicting difficulty in getting the host sites to complete their work on time. He knew how heavily the principal investigators relied on graduate students, and Hart worried that the project could be derailed because of a graduate student's failure to treat the schedule seriously enough. Days spent discussing the host-to-IMP specification turned into weeks. It became obvious that unless someone on Hart's team seized the task of just writing the specification, there would be more talk and little writing. Kahn took it upon himself to write the specification, and his colleagues were happy to let him. Hart thought Kahn was the best writer the group had, so he stood back and let Kahn produce the specification that became known as BBN Report 1822. Some people thought Hart worried excessively about potential engineering failures. He was a most defensive driver when it came to engineering. Hart had learned cautious engineering early on from his mentor at Lincoln Lab, Jay Forrester, the inventor of core memory. Forrester had drummed reliability into the heads of a whole generation of MIT engineers. Above cost, performance, or anything else, reliability was their top priority. Design for it, build for it, prepare for the worst, and above all, don't put your machine in a position to fail. Hart's mantra built reliability into the IMP in a thousand ways right from the start. Computer manufacturers were known to cut corners in order to compete on price and build new machines on time. They almost always paid some price in terms of higher failure rates, bugs and computer crashes, but usually it didn't ruin reputations. From Roberts to Hart, on down the line, all of the IMP guys expected a higher standard in this project. A network running 24 hours a day would demand solid performance from the BBN-built IMPs. The accepted imperative was that the IMPs would do their best to deliver each and every message accurately. A line might fail, even a host machine might fail, but the IMPs should not. Reliability was, in a sense, the founding principle of the network. The ARPA network would always reflect Frank Hart's own steady character. Ornstein had a reputation as a hard taskmaster, and he was very effective as a technical examiner. His trademark line was, "I'm just a dumb hardware guy. Convince me." He wouldn't let go until the explanation made sense to him. Often he uncovered some hidden soft spot. Many of the planning sessions at BBN took place in the Weiner Room, a high-ceilinged conference room with a big square table and plenty of chalkboards. It was conveniently located at an intersection of corridors in the middle of BBN's systems division, a crossroads between the 516 computer room, the lunchroom, and Hart's office. The Weiner Room served as a regular gathering place for the IMP guys. The IMP team was small enough, their offices close enough, and contact among team members frequent enough that formal design reviews were unnecessary. They talked in the hallways, sat in one another's offices, debated, and shared ideas constantly. In the winer room, chalk was applied liberally and often to explain, diagram, outline, argue, and teach. Ornstein used the room to hold an informal lecture series, in which software and hardware were explained in detail, and occasionally visitors would come in to talk about technical subjects. The whole team shared information. Everybody knew everything, as Crowther put it. The team members also wrote a numbered series of informal technical notes that they circulated among themselves. The notes didn't have a strict format, but always began, "The Imp Guy's Notes." They wrote down their ideas, exchanged them, and then usually got together to discuss them. The notes also gave Hart a way of monitoring their progress. Hart's reviews of the work as it matured were nothing like traditional design reviews. A design review is usually a major event in the course of an engineering project. An engineering team may work for weeks preparing a design for review, then come together to submit, elaborate on, and debate it under the scrutiny of colleagues and senior engineers. Hart's reviews tended to be ad hoc and ongoing, which isn't to say they were easy. "It was like your worst nightmare for an oral exam by someone with psychic abilities," recalled Bernie Cosell, the team's ace software troubleshooter. "He could intuit the parts of the design you were least sure of, the places you understood least well, the areas where you were just song and dancing, trying to get by, and cast an uncomfortable spotlight on parts you least wanted to work on, meanwhile virtually ignoring the parts you were so proud of for having gotten really nailed down and done right." Like the less frequent meetings with Roberts, Hart's design reviews were meant to help thrash through the hard parts, Cosell said. Hart had implicit respect for the things his engineers did that worked well, but he was sparing with his praise. His attitude seemed to be, "Why waste time with that? Younger and less experienced engineers might have been devastated by the lack of positive feedback from Hart, but the imp guys were a seasoned, closely knit, self-assured bunch, well accustomed to Hart's ways." Because of Hart's insistence on reliability and Kahn's early analysis of this area, a large number of error control mechanisms were designed into the system. Every communication system is prone to errors in transmission, caused by noise in the communication circuits. Voices passing through telephones and analog transmission can be garbled or ambiguous, as when the sounds of S and F are confused. Digital transmissions can also be distorted. A 1 can come through as a 0 and vice versa. Errors occur in bursts. If a given bit is in error, the probability of surrounding bits being in error is much higher than normal. Despite these problems, there are good techniques for detecting and even correcting digital errors, and the imps would have to rely on them. Digital error correction rests upon the basic idea of the checksum, a relatively small number that is calculated from the data at its source, then transmitted along with the data and recalculated at the destination. If the original and recalculated numbers do not agree, there has been an error in the transmission, unless perhaps the checking hardware itself failed, a very unlikely proposition. Checksums appear in data transmissions of all kinds. For instance, every beep you hear at the supermarket checkout counter signifies that a tiny laser has scanned a barcode and transmitted its digits to a computer where the checksum has been calculated and found to be correct. The machine at the checkout counter has done some sophisticated decimal arithmetic along the way by shuffling, multiplying, and adding the scanned digits, all in the blink of an eye. In most supermarket systems, the result must end in 0, the single-digit checksum used for all products. If a product is scanned and the computer fails to beep, it means the arithmetic didn't check. If the computer had a way of correcting the error, it would beep on every pass and save time. But error-correcting techniques add cost to the system, so the checkout person must pass the item through the scanner again,
perhaps two or three times until the code is transmitted without error. The IMP guys faced a similar problem. If a checksum detected a packet error on the network, how should it be handled? Should the transmitting IMP send the packet again, or should the receiving IMP be augmented with hardware to correct the error? In a network, error correction eats up space on the communication circuits and increases hardware expense in the switching equipment. Consequently, the BBN team decided that if an IMP detected an error in a packet, it would discard the packet without acknowledging receipt. The source IMP, still possessing a duplicate packet and still awaiting acknowledgement but not getting it, would then retransmit the duplicate. Before issuing the request for proposals, Roberts had to decide on the type of checksum for the IMPs. How many bits should be assigned to it, and how sophisticated should it be? The precise requirement, based on an average number of errors in the phone lines, was difficult to determine, because there was no hard information available about error rates on the high-speed lines over which the data was to be sent. Still, it was obvious that a 1-bit checksum would never do, nor would a 2-bit, or even an 8-bit. Even a 16-bit checksum might not be good enough. Kahn had earlier documented that a 16-bit checksum might not be sufficiently powerful to reach the desired level of reliability in the network, especially given the uncertainty in error performance of the high-speed lines. Kahn shared with Roberts some rough calculations that strongly suggested a 24-bit checksum would be a much better choice, pointing out that the extra 8 bits added very little expense to the hardware. The checksum was one of many technical issues on which Roberts listened to Kahn's advice, and a 24-bit checksum got written into the RFP. Later, Kahn argued the same case convincingly to Crowther and the others, and the IMP guys settled on the 24-bit checksum as one vital piece of the error control system. The BBN engineers had good intuition for which problems to solve in hardware and which ones to solve in software. It made sense to let the IMP's hardware calculate the checksum, because a software calculation would be too slow. The final IMP-to-IMP error detection scheme was a clever mix of known engineering techniques and others of the BBN team's own invention. As Crowther put it, "We'd steal ideas from anywhere, but most of the time we had to roll our own." On Valentine's Day 1969, Cambridge was socked in by a snowstorm. About 2 dozen people were in attendance at an all-day meeting at BBN. This was the first meeting between Hart's team and the researchers and graduate students from the host sites. Through Hart's cautious eyes, the crowd of mostly graduate students looked hungry to get their hands on the IMPs. He suspected that when ARPA decided to put the IMPs out at the sites, the researchers expected to have another computer to play with. He imagined they'd want to use the IMPs for all sorts of other things, to play chess or calculate their income taxes. "I took an extraordinarily rigid position," Hart recalled. "They were not to touch. They weren't to go near it. They were to barely look at it. It was a closed box with no switches available." Kahn was still hard at work on the host-to-IMP interface specification, so it remained unclear to host team members exactly what they'd be required to build. Some people from the host sites asked to see what BBN had in mind, but the IMP guys hadn't settled on a plan among themselves. On that issue, nothing much was resolved at the meeting. The graduate students decided to share with BBN a plan they had devised for the host to compute an end-to-end checksum. This would provide an extra layer of protection against errors in host-to-host communications. It was designed to catch various imagined errors, including the possible misassembly of message packets by the IMPs. Hart was distressed to hear this, because it would slow down the hosts and make the entire system appear slow. Nor did the very idea that the IMPs might pass damaged packets up to the host sit well with him.
the students argued that BBN's 24-bit checksum didn't cover the paths from the imps to the host computers, and that bits traveled naked between the two machines. Hart assured everyone, in no uncertain terms, that the imp checksum would be reliable. It remained to be seen, and in time the students would be more right than wrong. But with Hart's confidence on display, the host sites dropped their plans to include a checksum in the host protocols. More problematic was the idea of connecting multiple host computers to the imp at each site. When Roberts first designed the network, his idea was to connect one, and only one, host computer to each imp. However, by the Valentine's Day meeting, representatives from the sites were making it clear that they wanted to connect more than one host computer to each imp. Every research center had multiple computers, and it made sense to try to connect more than one machine per site if possible. Robert sent word to Cambridge that BBN was to redesign the imp to handle up to four hosts apiece. Walden, Crowther, and Cosell invented a clever way to do it. After Valentine's Day, the imp guys really went to work. Their working hours stretched long into the night. Hart, who lived in the rural town of Lincoln, tried to get home in time to have dinner, but often he didn't make it. It was easier for the others to go home for dinner and return to work, or not go home at all. When he was deep into the project, Crowther would sit at his terminal until he fell asleep. Now the real pressure was on Kahn. He spent much of the next 2 months on the phone with people at the host sites, grinding away at the interface specification. Kahn became BBN's main point of contact with the host research community. Researchers called him regularly to check what was happening, and what the schedule was, or simply to pass along new ideas. By mid-April, Kahn finished the specification, a thick document describing how a host computer should communicate with a packet switch, or IMP. It had been written partly keeping in mind what we'd been told the hosts wanted, and quite a lot keeping in mind what was going to be possible to implement, and what made sense to us, said Walden. A committee of representatives of the host sites reviewed it and told BBN where they didn't think it would work. The specification was revised until an acceptable design was reached. The host sites had something to build now. The UCLA team, which would be first, had less than 5 months to get ready for the arrival of its imp. Hart had drawn a clear line between what the imps would handle and what the hosts would do. Early on, Frank made a decision, a very wise decision, to make a clean boundary between the host responsibilities and the network responsibilities, said Crowther. Hart and his team decided to put maximum logical separation between the imp and the host. It made conceptual and design sense for them to draw the line there to avoid cluttering or crowding the imp's function. This also made building the imps more manageable. All imps could be designed the same, rather than being customized for each site. It also kept BBN from being caught in the middle, having to mediate among the host sites over the network protocols. BBN had agreed with Roberts that the imps wouldn't perform any host-to-host functions. That was a large technical problem. There were neither language standards nor word-length standards. So far, nothing that would facilitate easy communication between hosts. Even individual manufacturers, such as Digital, built a number of wholly incompatible computers. The last thing BBN wanted was the additional headache of solving the host-to-host problems. Furthermore, Roberts didn't want to give BBN or any other contractor that much control over the network design. Roberts was determined to distribute responsibilities evenly. Between Roberts and BBN, it was settled. The IMP would be built as a messenger, a sophisticated store-and-forward device, nothing more. Its job would be to carry bits, packets, and messages. To disassemble messages, store packets, check for errors, route the packets, and send acknowledgments for packets arriving error-free.
and then to reassemble incoming packets into messages and send them up to the host machines, all in a common language. The IMPs were designed to read only the first 32 bits of each message. This part of the message, originally called a leader and later changed to header, specified either the source or destination, and included some additional control information. The leader contained the minimal data needed to send and process a message. These messages were then broken into packets within the source IMP. The burden of reading the content of the messages would be on the hosts themselves. The host computer spoke many different languages, and the hardest part of making the network useful was going to be getting the host to communicate with each other. The host sites would have to get their disparate computers to talk to each other by means of protocols they agreed on in advance. Spurred by ARPA, the host community was making an organized effort to begin resolving these protocol issues, knowing it would be quite a while before anything was settled definitively. One spring day, a delivery truck from Honeywell turned down Moulton Street. Inside was the first 516 machine built to BBN specifications. The refrigerator-sized computer was brought off the truck and onto a loading dock at the back of the systems division building and then was rolled into a large room, soon to be known as the IMP Room, adjacent to the dock. The team had converted a storeroom into space for testing the IMPs by adding a raised computer floor, bright fluorescent lighting, and air conditioning. The windowless room was where the youngest man on the team, 22-year-old Ben Barker, would soon spend a lot of time. Barker was an undergraduate student whose brilliance had caught Ornstein's attention in one of the classes he taught at Harvard. When BBN was awarded the ARPA contract, Hart had offered Barker a job, and Barker had taken a leave of absence to accept it. Barker, like Ornstein, was a hardware engineer, and he showed signs of becoming an ace debugger, someone who could rescue a project when the time came. He was placed in charge of setting up each IMP Honeywell delivered and debugging the hardware before it left BBN's shop. The first machine was the prototype, IMP number 0, a non-ruggedized 516 containing Honeywell's initial implementation of BBN's interfaces. With the machine in the middle of the room, Barker ran power to the computer, plugged everything in, and turned it on. Barker had built a tester and had written some debugging code. He was looking forward to working out whatever bugs the machine had. Undoubtedly, there would be something that would need fixing, because there always was. Bugs were part of the natural process of computer design. Hart and the whole team looked forward to finding out which parts of the IMP design worked and which needed more attention. Barker tried loading the first IMP diagnostic program into the untested machine. He couldn't get it to work. So he loaded some other code, and that didn't work either. Barker tried a few other things and discovered that nothing worked. "The machine didn't come close to doing anything useful," he said. So far, the first IMP was a fizzling dud. Prior to the IMP project, people at BBN and Honeywell had interacted casually, and relations were friendly. In the days leading up to the IMP project, a sense of teamwork grew. Honeywell had devoted a special systems crew to work on the BBN contract from day one. At BBN's request, Honeywell had assigned one of its technicians exclusively to the task of shepherding Honeywell's part of the job to completion. This was unusual. In general, mini-computer manufacturers like Honeywell didn't cater much to the special demands of their customers. "Most computer companies won't build specials at all," said Hart. "Or if they do, it's under great duress." Mini-computer salespeople went after a broad market, while mainframe computer makers were known to treat customers like royalty. Nobody in the mini-computer business did much hand-holding. In the wake of IMP No. 0's gross failure, BBN's hardware chief Ornstein began to go over the design with the Honeywell team. He discovered that no one at Honeywell seemed to understand in much detail how the BBN-designed interfaces were supposed to work.
He was surprised to learn that the technicians building the first interface didn't really understand the drawings. Honeywell hadn't attempted to develop any diagnostics to test the design. It had simply tried to produce a faithful implementation of the block diagrams that Ornstein had drawn, and that BBN had included in its proposal to ARPA. The trouble was that in furnishing Honeywell with a set of fairly generic block diagrams, BBN assumed that Honeywell's familiarity and expertise with its own machines would enable the computer manufacturer to anticipate any peculiar problems with BBN's requested modifications to the Model 516. Honeywell had its own logic modules and its own design system. But instead of working out the essential details in the blueprints, Honeywell had built BBN's machine without verifying that the BBN-designed interfaces, as drawn, would work with the 516 base model. Of course, neither BBN in drawing the block diagrams nor Honeywell in implementing the design actually had all of the necessary tools to create a perfectly working prototype IMP on the first pass. In building new computers, said Barker, the operative assumption is that you design something you think will work, get the prototype ready, start testing, then gradually fix the design errors until the machine passes the test. It would have been an engineering fluke if the machine ran perfectly straight away. But even as a first pass, the condition of this prototype machine was unacceptable. If Ornstein was concerned about Honeywell's performance, Barker was downright nervous. As the chief debugger, he was the one responsible for getting the machine to actually work. At this stage in the IMP project, the interfaces on the 516, he said, wouldn't have come close to working even if Honeywell had implemented them properly. Barker was staring at weeks of concentrated work ahead. He felt the weight of the schedule suddenly grow heavier. If the BBN hardware team intended to hand off to the BBN programming team a working version of the modified Honeywell 516 anytime soon, so that Crowther, Walden, and Cosell would have time for final debugging of their operating code, then the hardware specialist would have to hustle. With Ornstein's help, Barker would have to take the stuff Honeywell had built, he said, and figure out how to make it actually do what it was intended to do. The arrival of the prototype IMP in its initial state marked a real setback. Correcting the course would take time, and soon there would be precious little of that. Armed with an oscilloscope, a wire-wrap gun, and an unwrap tool, Barker worked alone on the machine 16 hours a day. The circuitry of the computer relied on pin blocks, or wire-wrapped boards, that served as the central connection points to which wires, hundreds upon hundreds of wires, were routed. There were numerous blocks of 34 pins into which logic boards were plugged, and which carried components to form the correct circuits. After figuring out where the wire should actually go, Barker had to unwrap each tightly wound misconnected wire from its pin. The pins in each block were about an inch long, and were closely spaced, 1/20 of an inch apart, in a square matrix. Each block looked like a miniature bed of nails with wire streaming Medusa-like into and out of it. Once he determined where the correct wire should be reconnected, Barker used the wire-wrap gun to wrap each wire carefully on its correct pin. It was a long, laborious, and delicate process. To complicate matters, Barker had a slight palsy in his hands. Working with a wire-wrap gun called for a steady hand and good concentration. The close spacing of the pins, the weight of the wire-wrap gun, and the size of the nozzle on the gun that had to be slipped down over a single pin amid a small forest of pins all conspired against him. The risk was in getting the wire on the wrong pin, or bending or breaking a pin. You could destroy a lot of fine work if you weren't careful. So the shake in Barker's hands caused quite a stir among the other IMP guys when Barker took his wire-wrap gun to the pin blocks inside the IMP. Most of the rewiring was done with the power off. When something had to be done with the power on, it was done with little clip leads that slipped onto the pins. Here, though, there was a very real danger of shorting things out and blowing circuits. Barker spent months debugging the machine. Ornstein was overseeing the design corrections in the prototype and making sure they got relayed back to Honeywell's engineers. The next machine Honeywell was scheduled to deliver would be the first ruggedized 516 with all the design bugs worked out. Imp number one destined for UCLA. "The sweat was to get working designs in time to ship," said Barker. The summer was upon them. Hart's wariness about the hordes of curious graduate students drove BBN to conceptualize even greater measures of protection for the imps. In time, among the most creative things Hart's team did was invent ways of obtaining critical operating data from the network imps, reading the machine's vital signs, unobtrusively from a distance. Hart wanted to be able to sit at a terminal in Cambridge and see what an imp in Los Angeles, Salt Lake City, or any place else was doing. BBN's full implementation of remote diagnostic tools and debugging capabilities would later become a huge asset. When the network matured, remote control would enable BBN to monitor and maintain the whole system from one operation center, collecting data and diagnosing problems as things changed. Periodically, each imp would send back to Cambridge a snapshot of its status, a set of data about its operating conditions. Changes in the network, minor and major, could be detected. Hart's group envisioned someday being able to look across the network to know whether any machine was malfunctioning or any line was failing, or perhaps if anyone was meddling with the machines. Nonetheless, BBN still hadn't even gotten the prototype imp to a state in which it could run operational code. And the programming team, Crowther, Walden, and Cosell, was now moving into difficult territory, the design of a flexible or dynamic routing system, allowing alternative routing so that packets would automatically flow around troubled nodes and links. A fixed routing scheme would have been straightforward. You would send a packet with clear instructions to travel via X, Y, and Z points on the map. But if point Y was knocked out, all traffic would be held up, and that would thwart one of the advantages of a network with multiple links and nodes. The original request from ARPA had specified dynamic routing, without offering a clue as how to make it work. Crowther had found a way to do it. He was building a system of dynamic routing tables that would be updated every split second or so. These tables would tell the imps in which direction to forward each packet that hadn't yet reached its destination. The routing tables would reflect such network conditions as line failures and congestion, and they would route packets the shortest way possible. Making this design actually work seemed a mind-bending problem, until Crowther came up with a simple, perfect set of code. "Crowther always had his head right down in the bits," as Ornstein described Crowther's uncanny, intuitive talent. Crowther's dynamic routing algorithm was a piece of programming poetry. "It was incredibly minimalistic and worked astoundingly well," Walden observed. Crowther was regarded by his colleagues as being within the top fraction of 1% of programmers in the world. On occasion, the graceful minimalism of Crowther's code wasn't enough to handle the complexity of real-world systems. Other programmers would have to fine-tune what Crowther had created. But his core ideas were more often than not brilliant. "Most of the rest of us made our livings handling the details resulting from Will's use of his brain," Walden observed. Flow control was another programming challenge. But when Kahn looked at Crowther's code and saw how he had implemented control of the flow of packets from one side of the network to the other, he was worried. Messages between hosts were to be transmitted by the subnet over logical links. The subnet would accept one message at a time on a given link. Messages waiting to enter the subnet were stored in a memory buffer, a waiting area inside the machine in a queue. The next message wasn't sent until the sending imp received an acknowledgment, similar to a return receipt, saying that the previous message had arrived error-free at the destination host. When one link was cleared and a new message could be sent, the subnet would notify the sending imp by means of a special control signal that the BBN engineers called Ready for Next Message, or RFNM, pronounced Roughnum. Messages in the sending host's buffers, waiting for links to clear, were like patrons in a restaurant waiting for tables. Roughnums were the equivalent of the maitre d's announcing, "Your table is ready." This meant it was impossible to send a continuous stream of messages over any single link through the system from one host to another. Roughnum was a congestion control strategy designed to protect the imps from overload, but at the expense of reducing service to the host. Kahn had studied the problem of congestion control even before the ARPA network project began. His reaction to Crowther's solution was that the links and roughnums would still allow fatal congestion of the network's arteries. The imp's buffers would fill up, he said. You'd have incomplete messages sitting in the receiving imps, waiting for their final packets to arrive so the entire message could be reassembled, and there would be no room for the packets to arrive. Kahn's reassembly lockup scenario was an analog in the shipping business. Say that a Toyota dealership in Sacramento orders sets of replacement engine blocks and pistons from a warehouse in Yokohama. Both items together are essential for the jobs the dealer has at hand. In the Yokohama harbor, freighters are loading large containers, all the same size, filled with products of many kinds. The engine blocks and pistons wind up in separate ships. When the container of engine blocks arrives in San Francisco, it is unloaded to a warehouse of containers whose contents are also partial shipments, awaiting the arrival of other parts before being sent onward. Components for television sets, pin blocks for pianos, and so on. When the freighter with the pistons arrives, it finds the warehouse full. Every later ship has the same problem. Nobody can unload. Nothing can leave the warehouse. Deadlock. Solution? The Yokohama shipper agrees to call ahead next time to reserve space for all containers that go together. If space is unavailable, he waits until it becomes available before shipping. Kahn also predicted another type of deadlock that might lead to loss of packets. He said that it would occur in heavy traffic within the subnet when the buffers of one imp were filled with packets routed to another and vice versa. A kind of standoff would result, in which neither one would be able to accept the other's packets. The way the routing software had been written, the imps would discard the packets. Kahn and Crowther debated the gridlock question at length. Over points such as these, Kahn's conceptual views came into open conflict with the pragmatic bent of the rest of the imp guys, and cracked open a wide disagreement between them. The rest of the team just wanted to get the network up and running on schedule. As the network grew, they'd have time to improve its performance, work out problems, and perfect the algorithms. But Kahn persisted. "I could see things that, to me, were obvious flaws," he said. "The most obvious one was that the network could deadlock." Kahn was certain the network would lock up, and he told Hart and the others so immediately. They argued with him. Bob was interested in the theory of things and the math, but he wasn't really interested in the implementation, said Crowther. Crowther and Kahn began to talk it through, and the two had what Crowther described as grand little fights. The flow control scheme wasn't designed for a huge network, and with a small number of nodes, Crowther thought they could get by with it. Hart thought that Kahn was worrying too much about hypothetical, unlikely network conditions. His approach was to wait and see. Some of the others thought Kahn didn't understand many of the problems with which they were grappling. "Some of the things he was suggesting were off the wall, just wrong," said Ornstein. Kahn wanted to watch simulations of network traffic on a screen. He wanted to have a program that would show packets moving through the network. In fact, the packets would never move at a humanly observable speed, they'd be going zip-zip in microseconds and milliseconds. We said, "Bob, you'll never understand the problems looking at it that way." The other imp guys respected Khan, but some believed he was going in the wrong direction. Gradually, they paid less attention to him. "Most of us in the group were trying to get Khan out of our hair," Ornstein said. Hart scotched Khan's suggestion that they use a simulation. Hart hated to see his programming team spend time on simulations or on writing anything but operational code. They were already becoming distracted by something else he disliked, building software tools. Hart feared delay. Over the years he had seen too many programmers captivated by tool building, and he had spent a career holding young engineers back from doing things that might waste money or time. The people in Hart's division knew that if they asked him for the okay to clock hours writing editors, assemblers, and debuggers, they would meet with stiff resistance, perhaps even a shouting match. So no one ever asked. They just did it, building tools when they thought it was the right thing to do, regardless of what Hart thought. This was software they would eventually need when the time came to test the system. All were customized pieces of programming specifically designed for the ARPA project. As summer peaked, a troubling problem loomed. BBN was still awaiting Honeywell's delivery of the first production IMP, with all the debugged interfaces built to BBN specifications. The programming team had given up waiting and gone ahead with its work by loading a lower-grade development machine with a simulation program the team had designed to mimic the operations of the production model IMP and its I/O interfaces. Still, testing the software on the real machine was the preferred approach. And whenever the machine came in, Barker would first need time to debug it. The time left was dwindling. By late summer, the machine still hadn't crossed BBN's loading dock. Scheduled delivery of the IMP to California was now only a few weeks away, and BBN's own reputation was on the line. Finally, about 2 weeks before Labor Day, Honeywell rushed the first ruggedized 516 IMP out its shop door and over to Cambridge. As soon as the machine touched the floor at BBN, Barker was ready to work on it. He powered up IMP number 1 in the back room. Barker loaded the IMP diagnostic code. When he tried running it, nothing happened. The machine didn't respond. On closer inspection, it was apparent that the machine BBN received was not what it had ordered. This 516 had few of the modifications that Barker and Ornstein had worked out painstakingly in debugging the prototype. In fact, it was wired just like the original dysfunctional prototype had been wired. With the deadline closing in, Barker had only one recourse: fix it at BBN. This time, at least, he already knew where every wire should go. With the machine sitting in the middle of the large room, Barker went to work implementing all of the design modifications necessary to make it a functioning IMP. Within a few days, Barker had coaxed the machine to life. He managed to activate the IMP's interfaces, whereupon the computer began crashing at random intervals. The randomness of the crashes was unusually bad. Intermittent problems of this sort were the devil. The IMP would run for anywhere from 12 hours to 40 hours at a stretch, then die and be somewhere off in the boonies. What to do? Recalled Ornstein. We couldn't figure out what the hell was going on. As Labor Day approached, they pressured the IMP, putting it through as many hard tests as possible. It might run fine for 24 hours, then inexplicably die. Barker would look for a clue, chase what appeared to be a problem, fix it, and still the machine would crash again. With only a few days left before the delivery deadline, it looked like they were not going to make it. Barker, who had been nursing the computer, suspected the problem was in the machine's timing chain. It was just a hunch. The IMP had a clock used by the operating system to keep time in the machine. Not as humans would, by marking seconds, minutes, or hours, but counting time in 1 microsecond, 1 million ticks per second increments. Fast for its day, but 100 times slower than today's personal computers. This clock provided a framework in which the imp operated, and it regulated the computer's many functions synchronously. In a communication system, messages arrive unannounced. Signals interrupt the machine asynchronously. Like a telephone call in the middle of a dinner, an incoming packet shows up on its own schedule at the imp's door and says, "Take me now." The computer had a sophisticated system for handling the incoming interruptions in a methodical manner, so as not to upset the synchronous operation of all its functions. If not properly designed, such synchronizers can be thrown off by an incoming signal occurring at just the wrong moment. Synchronizer bugs are rare, but when they occur and the synchronizer fails to respond properly to an interrupt, the consequences are profoundly disturbing to the machine's total operation. One might call it a nervous breakdown. Computer scientists have another term for it. The synchronizer goes into a metastable condition. "Under such circumstances," Ornstein said, "the machine invariably dies in a hopelessly confused state, different each time." Ornstein knew all too well about synchronizer bugs. He had dealt with the problem in the computer he and Wes Clark had built a few years earlier in St. Louis. Ornstein was the author of some of the first published papers on the subject, and was one of the few people in the world who actually had any experience with this particular gremlin. Their unpredictability made synchronizer bugs among the most frustrating of bugs, because of the absence of any recognizable pattern to the resulting crashes. Unlike most other problems that could cause computers to crash, a synchronizer bug left behind virtually no useful forensic evidence that might point a diagnostician to the problem. In fact, the absence of clues was one of the most useful clues. Furthermore, the failures caused by this bug were so infrequent, only once every day or so, even in full-bore tests, that it was impossible to detect any evidence on an oscilloscope. Only the most astute debuggers had any idea what they were dealing with. This seemed to be the problem Ornstein and Barker had on their hands. But who knew, because you couldn't actually trace it? What to do now? The Honeywell 516 had never been used in an application as demanding as the packet switching network. It was a fast machine. The IMP guys had chosen it precisely for its I/O capabilities. No one else was likely ever to see the problem in a typical application of the 516 computer. "If their machine died once a year," Ornstein said, "they'd never notice. They would just restart." But the IMP guys were driving the machine hard. The flow of packets into and out of the IMP happened faster than the Honeywell designers had anticipated. The 516 machine didn't seem capable of handling such traffic. Maybe BBN had been overly optimistic. Ornstein and Barker went to Honeywell and insisted that the manufacturer dig out of the woodwork way in the back room the designer of the 516 computer. He was a very smart guy, Ornstein had to admit, but at first the Honeywell man refused to admit that a metastable state was possible in the machine. He had never read Ornstein's paper and had never seen the problem. "Though filled with disbelief," said Ornstein, "he at least understood what we were saying." Under normal conditions, the 516 would run for years without experiencing the synchronizer problem. However, under ARPA's packet switching network conditions, the machine was failing once every day or so. Try telling Frank Hart, Mr. Reliability, that he'd just have to live with that. Ornstein and Barker huddled. It was only a guess that the IMP had a synchronizer problem. To test the hypothesis, Ornstein designed and wired an aggravator that deliberately produced data requests at what Barker called a fierce rate. It increased the probability of getting interruptions at the exact nanosecond that would reveal the problem. The aggravator had a knob that worked like a tuner. Using the knob, Ornstein and Barker could tune the timing of requests to bring in a signal perfectly out of kilter with the clock, the worst case. Then, using an oscilloscope, they observed the machine's heartbeat and other internal functions. The debugging crew went to work. The patterns they were looking for on the oscilloscope would be so faint as to be visible only in a darkened room. So with all the lights out in the imp room, and with all their diagnostic equipment and the Honeywell turned on, they watched, while fooling with the aggravator. The traces they saw on the scope were bright, regularly positioned, and steadily paced, the vital signs of a healthy machine. Even with the aggravator, it took the debugging team quite a while to find what it was looking for. Still, every few minutes a very faint ghost trace flitted across the oscilloscope. Was that it? The fleeting trace was perhaps the only telltale sign that the crashes were caused by a timing problem. A synchronizer stalled in a metastable condition for a few nanoseconds too long. It was the computer equivalent of the one split second of confusion or indecision by a race car driver that ends suddenly in a fatal crash. The evidence seemed fairly incontrovertible, and Honeywell finally acknowledged it. In the meantime, Barker designed a possible fix and rewired the imp's central timing chain. When Barker brought the machine back up, loaded in his diagnostic code, and looked in the scope, the ghost traces were gone. While Barker and Ornstein were reasonably certain that the problem was fixed, they had no way of knowing for sure unless the machine ran for a few consecutive days without crashing. And they didn't have a few days. Hart had already approved shipping the first interface message processor to California the next day. Imp number one was almost out the door.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.